start the commission meeting in about a minute or two. Rogers, president of the California Fish and Game Commission. This is the October meeting here in beautiful Concord, which is raining, I guess, outside, or at least it was. Let me make a few introductions. Immediately to my right is Commissioner Michael Sutton from Monterey. To my left, around this guy here, is Commissioner Cindy Gustafson from Tahoe City. Beyond Cindy is Commissioner Jim Kellogg from Concord. Let's see. Why don't I start at the other end of the table? Bill Cunningham, Attorney General. Over at the table over there on that side is Acting Director of the Department, John McCammon. And next to John McCammon is Deputy Director Sankey Mastra. Let me see. Eric Loft is over there. Maria Vojkovic is here someplace. There she is, back there. We also have in the audience, standing at the back of the room, Deputy Director and Chief of the Wardens, Nancy Foley. And also assisting Nancy today is Captain Doug Fox. Where's Doug? There he is, right there. And we have Lieutenant John Laughlin and Wardens Jessica Jacobson and Raul Lamelli. And let me see. And our staff, John Fisher, Deputy Executive Director, over there at the end, not quite at the end. And at this end, Adriana Shea, Executive Director. And we have Sherry Cole down over there at the other end. And I didn't forget John Carlson, the Executive Director of the Commission, because you're about to hear him take it away.
Good morning. Thank you, Richard. For folks that are new today in the audience that weren't here yesterday, if you're interested in speaking on any items, please turn in a green speaker card to the staff to my left at the end of the table here, and for your agenda items. Also, we have a 10-minute cap total time on your speaking, so if you have several items you want to speak on, choose wisely. I also want to announce that we are on live internet streaming, so the meeting is being filmed, it's being transmitted over the internet live, and it's being recorded so that it can be watched later if you're interested, or for any parties that are interested in watching the meeting later, go to our website, and there are links to that, those archive files. So with that, we can get started. Item number 13, announcement of results from executive session. Mr. Bill Cunningham.
Good morning, Mr. President, members of the Commission. Bill Cunningham, Deputy Attorney General and Counsel for the California Fish and Game Commission. I'd like to report that the Commission did meet in executive session yesterday during the lunch break. This executive session is conducted pursuant to a government code section 11126, which allows the Commission to meet with its attorneys in closed session to discuss matters that are in litigation or pending litigation. We also have the ability to discuss items regarding licenses and permits, or sometimes our various staff and personnel issues. We did discuss some matters in litigation, but we took no action on any item currently on the agenda. And that's all I have to report. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill.
I have no public speaker cards on that issue. Item number 19, receipt of public testimony on proposed changes to amend, adopt, and repeal specific sections and subsections related to sport fishing, clarification, and cleanup. Please note that the adoption hearing is scheduled for November 2nd, 2007 in Sacramento on this issue. Sankey, I have listed Scott Barrow giving a presentation, but I don't, maybe that's changed.
Yeah, the commission's obviously had this document. It's a long series of largely technical cleanups and clarifications. You have it in your binder. The department has no more to add to this item, so we're here mostly to get.
Okay, thank you. We don't have any. Do we have any speaker cards on this? We do not have any speaker cards on this. Are there any questions or comments from the commissioners? Okay, let's move on to item 20.
Item 20, 20A, final certification of environmental document and adoption of findings and proposed project or alternative for proposed changes to sections 163 and 164, Title 14, related to herring. 20B is discussion and possible adoption of proposed changes to sections 163 and 164, Title 14, related to herring.
John, wait a minute.
Steve, I hate to be a pain to you, but will you turn this up? I can't hear my own guy.
Testing.
Just pull it a little closer.
Yeah, I'm almost eating. Okay, here we go. All right. For this, for the department, my understanding is for 20A, we're going to have a presentation by Sankey and Maria Vojkovic, 20A and 20B.
Good morning, Commissioners. Maria Vojkovic will be heading this off. As you know, the environmental document has been submitted and is ready for certification. And with that, we'll move to B, unless there's any questions on the environmental document. There's really nothing for us to add to it.
Any questions?
I didn't hear a thing Sankey said.
Sankey, could you repeat that, please, Sankey?
I will speak loudly.
Commissioner Kellogg has a head cold.
Oh. Commission, the final environmental document, item 20A, is in your binder. It's ready for certification. There are no unusual issues or comments that were received. This is something we've been doing every year, so it's ready for certification unless you have any specific issues or questions. We would then move to 20B, which would be the proposed regulations.
No questions? Okay. Maria? Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning.
The button is down at the there it is, right there. You had it. Just push it in.
There you go.
You got it.
I've got it now.
The light is on.
Great. Good morning, Commission. My name is Maria Vojkovic. I'm the regional manager for the Marine Region. And this morning, we come to you with regulations for the herring fishery, commercial herring fishery. As noted in the document, the CEQA document, the herring spawning biomass for this year predicted is the lowest on record since we've been conducting biomass estimates. And therefore, the department is recommending that the commission set a quota this year of 1,094 tons. We're also asking the commission to set the season dates and times of the fishery that is contained in the document. We're asking also that you change the regulation that requires fishermen to be near their nets. It's been traditionally 1 mile. We're recommending that be changed to a 3 mile distance. And there are a couple of administrative changes that are insignificant that are also contained in the regulations. And then the most significant request, I believe, is the granting of authority to the director of the Department of Fish and Game to set the season quota each year and the season dates and times. I can speak more specifically about the authority.
I would like you to, Maria, because you know, we have a director's appointed herring advisory committee, and
sure.
And we've had problems in the past over this fishery, and I'm, as one commissioner, I'm hesitant to make that change unless you can convince me different.
Sure. The proposed regulations actually set up a structure where in May of every year the director would be sending a letter to the commission and to the director's herring advisory committee informing them of what our recommendation would be for a quota and season dates and times. The commission could agendize that a discussion about the quota and the fishing year early. The season doesn't usually start until early December, so if we came to you in May with the recommendation from the director, it would provide enough time that if there was some question about the information or some issues that the fishing community had about our assessment, that could be discussed in the commission forum. And then the commission would have the opportunity to recommend to the director or have a discussion about what he would be planning to establish. So I think that within the regulations, there's also a sideboards on how what level the director could choose relative to the quota. It would be an amount of 0 to 15% of the spawning biomass, so there would be some sideboards on that. And then, of course, the opportunity to come in and discuss with the commission if there is some desire on the part of the commission. So it would be that the paper... the CEQA process that we've been using, where we have to redo our document each year and you certify it, that would not be taking place. We would use a programmatic document, and then we would just establish the quota through director's authority. The APA process with the notice and hearings and the three meetings and the paperwork that goes with that would not be coming to you then. So the intent here is to try and minimize the workload on both sides, commission and the department, but still maintain an opportunity for discussion and involvement of the DHAC.
Well, is it all right if I
please,
make
please
a comment
go ahead.
Again?
We do have a public speaker. Please go ahead.
You know what? I'll save my comments till after the public speakers. But there's some history here that the rest of you need to be aware of.
Yes, I know. And I know there's probably no one in the room with more knowledge of that than yourself. So.
Are there any other questions about the process that I described?
I actually have one question about that, the process you just described with respect to the coming back and with the quota. Is that codified in this? I couldn't find that. The director will come back in May and blah, blah, blah.
The opportunity exists. It doesn't say that right now in the regulation. Right. Right.
Okay.
So it's up to you to agendize.
No, so the go way ahead,
that,
Adrienne.
The way that staff has discussed this with a department director is that we have an agreement that in May we will have a formal agenda item, which is receipt of the department's memo.
Right.
If there are issues, and the director only has authority within the 15%, 0 to 15%. So if there are changes that need to occur, we still have time to do regulations like we do currently in I think we started in August.
July is usually
July.
When we notice.
So we'll still have enough time for that decision to be made if adjustments need to be made.
I understand that part of it, but my question was I wanted to make certain that that was, in a sense, codified so that should we have a change in directorship,
there would
that,
be a
that procedure
for a memo.
is not forgotten.
There
no,
would be a requirement for a
right.
formal memo.
Perfect. Thank you. We have one public speaker. John?
Yes, Sam Liberati, and he has time ceded to him, so he has a total of 5 minutes.
Mr. DeLon, good morning. My name is Sam Liberati. I'm 75 years old. I've been a fisherman since I was 9 years old.
Okay, I'm sorry. So you know more about this subject than
but Mr.
Kellogg.
For what I'm going to comment on, for the record, I want to tell you just a little bit about myself. I spent 44 years in Alaska fishing herring and salmon. I'm born and raised in California. Got my wife telling me what to do as usual.
I'd be lost without that myself, so.
I've been involved in the fisheries in Alaska and California as far back as I could remember. I was the founder of one of the biggest associations in Bristol Bay and president. I founded the original Herring Association in California. And you have to excuse me, I got to refer to my notes here. I should have been more prepared. I apologize for that. Now I got to find them. Okay, in California, I worked with Assemblyman Art Agnos to get the first emergency transfer bill regulation when a fisherman got sick so they could transfer the permit. Before that, the boat had a tie-up. I spent several years on Herring Advisory Committee and introduced regulations such as eliminating the round haul permit, reducing our gear by 50%, and I asked in Sacramento and got a herring stamp on us fishermen so that we could fund a new research vessel and new hydroacoustical sounding equipment. I remember then the director was amazed that we would ask for a tax on ourselves. But the biologists needed the money, and we felt that it was important that we get all the research we can get off the herring fishery. The last proposal I made was for smaller mesh net. Okay, a couple years back, the department recommended closing the herring fishery. And they put up a chart like they did at the meeting in Santa Barbara. I was ill at the time. We had sickness in the family also, and I couldn't make it to that meeting, but I was very upset when I watched it on the internet. When they put that chart up the first time to close the fishery, it was similar to that. Thanks to Mike Chrisman, then president of the committee, and Jim Kellogg, they listened to both sides. The chart painted a dark picture of the herring fishery. Ernie, who is our president of our association, I guess isn't here today. He presented the same information and showed the complete opposite picture with the Fish and Game Department's numbers and research. So here you take a bunch of numbers, you put them together, and you show what you want to show, and you put them together another way, and you show the complete opposite. That's the problem with these charts and graphs, because it's what you put in there. And what points you want to get across is what you're going to sell. You got very upset, Mr. Rogers, when you seen that chart about what's happening to the fishery. I remember your comments were something like, when you look at this, it really scares you. But I want to talk about them charts just a little bit. Now, I'm a fisherman, so I'm not going to talk size and year class. And all. I only know what I know. One of the reasons we stopped the round haulers is they were catching fish about that big. And we thought at the time that we can't hit on these schools like that without even giving these fish a chance to mature. Plus the quotas. They were on quotas. And a lot of cheating was being done. So myself with Frank Henry, we organized all the fishing, the gillnetters, to eliminate that fishery and give the ground haulers two permits. They were catching 50% of the quota. That's not mentioned in that chart. I think Jim Kellogg brought that up at the meeting in Santa Barbara.
The two were catching 50%.
Okay, I went before the commission after and asked for and got a reduction in our gear by 50%. Each permit used to fish with 120 fathoms for each permit. And I recommended and got passed a bill to cut our gear in half. These were all things brought up by the fishermen, not the department. Because we felt that the less gear we had in the water, the better off everybody would be, because we couldn't tend two nets, especially when you are fishing two groups. The herring stamp, why I pushed hard on that, with the help of the fishermen, the other fishermen in the herring fishery, was done because the boat was constantly broke down. The acoustical surveys were the main source of getting our quotas. If they didn't know what was out there, we weren't going to get a good quota. Since that time, the surveys are not being used when they calculate their quota of how much fish came in last year. Now, we that were out there 24 hours a day can tell you we probably estimated 50 to 60,000 ton last year. But unless all the information is used, what the department presents to you is just a guess, an idea. Everything, all the means that it takes to get a correct number are not being used. Now, we know for a fact that fish spawn in the deep water. We've had nets go down, come up with seaweed or whatever, rocks would spawn on them. They don't do any deep water surveys. So they have no idea how much fish is spawning in the deep. Last year, fish went all the way up to San Pablo Bay. We had spawns going on from there all the way down to the Golden Gate and out. Most of that wasn't recorded because most of the time the boat was broke down. And the one thing I would love to see the department do is get up here, and one day I hope to see it, and say, hey, these are estimates. We're short-handed. They don't have enough biologists. I'm sure they're doing the best they could, but they don't have enough people to get proper surveys. And to come before this commission and give you definite numbers is wrong. The letter, Mr. Sutton, that you got from the fisherman doesn't surprise me one bit. I know the guy. And on our herring advisory committee, more than once we've had fishermen recommend closing the season. Because one of the things that I want you all to be aware of, we are just as concerned about the welfare of those herring as any one of you guys sitting up there, and maybe even more, because we have investments in this fishery. The last thing we want to do is overfish it. And more than once, that recommendation has been made at our advisory meetings. And we all decided against it for different reasons. But this fishery is not sick. This fishery is very healthy. There's a lot of things going out in that ocean outside that are having these fish come in smaller than they were. I believe it's happening with the sardines. Happening with a lot of fish out there. I don't think the biologist could even answer that question. But the numbers of fish, if you go out in that bay, and you set on solid fish, and your net comes up with nothing, that's telling you that something's wrong. We also have a problem with sea lions. And also the catch numbers. We were setting last year on solid fish, and you got 200-300 sea lions going up and down the nets. You're not going to catch any fish when they do that. And if you do catch 1,000 pounds of fish where you have an opportunity to catch them, you're not going to catch them because the sea lions eat them. I mean, all this should be considered when you take a catch figure and then you say, look at this, they didn't catch nothing, so there's no fish. But there's many reasons why we don't catch them. Number one, for years, and in that chart that shows those big numbers, we were using nets as small as 2 inch, even though it wasn't written in the law that way. If you look at the regulations, you see 2 1/4, then 2 1/8. Now, when you take 2 1/8, I showed gill nets here, nylon nets, how they stretch, and I took a 2 1/16 and showed the commission. But the nylon stretches like a rubber band. The way to measure nets in Alaska and here at the time was with a 5-pound weight, 10 meshes. So what the department did would say, we got to get a smaller size without changing the regulations on the mesh size. So what they did, they said, okay, we take the 5-pound weight off and we'll use a 1/2-pound weight. Well, your nets don't even stretch. That meant that you could not use any more 2 1/16, any more 2 inch, or anything other than 2 1/8. They gave us 1 year to get new gear. That reflects in those numbers on that chart. I want to make sure I don't forget nothing here, so bear with me for another minute, please. Okay. I guess I've just about covered everything except the last question that was brought up on turning things over to the director to decide the quotas. You know, you people are our day in court. We could come before you and express our problems and give our reasons. Don't take that away from us. And it's my understanding that you're up there to protect the resource in the state of California. So don't take it away from yourself. Not the director, not Zonke, not me, not anybody should have the right to make the decisions without having open debate like this. So I'm pleading with you, please, take that out of those regulations, on those proposals. Because all the fishermen are against that. The advisory committee that we have gives us a chance to be heard. Sometimes, you know, we talk to deaf ears, but we still have a chance to be heard. We have a chance to come before you and say, hey, I guess you got my point on that. And the last thing I want to comment is because we weren't at the meeting in Santa Barbara, and you people had some kind of farewell things for Ryan Broadwick. So, as a herring fisherman, I'd like to go on public record that Ryan Broadwick was one of the best directors that I've ever seen, here or Alaska. And trying to fill his shoes is going to be almost impossible. And we wish him the best, no matter what he does. And if you have any questions now, I'll be happy to answer.
Thank you, Mr. Liberati. Are there any questions from the commission? This is our only public speaker. Okay. Nope, we have another.
I just noticed several people came in the room while Sam was speaking. If there's anyone else who wants to speak on this issue, now is the time to turn in your card.
And you have to have a card in. There is someone who wants to speak on this issue? Okay. Thank you, Mr. O'Brien.
Thank you.
We will hold for the next speaker card.
Why don't you come up to the microphone if you want to speak?
There's one. They're off again. My microphone is off again. Oh, okay.
Sorry for being ill-prepared. I'm NHSBC.
That's all right. I'm sorry, you have to hand the card in.
Okay,
yes, thank you.
Fill it out. So they were telling me, go. Take your time to fill it out.
Yes, I'm sorry. Take your time to fill it out.
Sir, come on. You can announce your name and hand us the card as you're when you're done talking. With your name, we need it for the record.
Okay. I'm Eddie Genovese. I'm a Herring Advisory Committee member, and I am a little.
Mr. Genovese, how do you spell your last name?
Genovese.
Thank you, sir.
Sorry for being a little ill-prepared. I thought I'd have a little bit more time. There was an agenda item before us so that would take some time, but my fault. Anyway, just wanted to comment on a couple things. About the department taking over, setting the quota. I'm probably repeating a lot of things Sam said, but I feel that, you know, the commission is a checks and balances system. Not that the department is against us or anything, but because of lack of funding for reasons we all know about, their surveys aren't as in-depth as they should be. And so we feel that we're out there looking at fish all the time, fishing, and we have an input too. And I noticed that they said they'd take over setting the quota and the dates. And it said that they would take input from the advisory committee on the herring dates, but it said nothing about taking input from the advisory committee about the quota, which is an area that we're getting into that we used to be in, that we've come around and started communicating with them better and making a lot of progress. And then when we see that, when I saw that, it kind of reminds me of a couple years ago before we came together a little bit better with a lot of help from the commission and the department, the upper staff in the department. So I believe that the commission should still make the final decision on the quota with recommendations from the department, relying on them heavily because they're very good biologists. But we have input too, and then you guys sort it out. I really feel strongly about that. The other thing is, I saw a videotape of the last meeting, and there was a gentleman up here, and he was talking about the fishery and the decline in the fishery and stuff. And I wish that it would be qualified, like the seiners are gone, so that's a reason that different year classes are being caught. The price went down, so the effort was down, and that's a reason for less fish being caught and stuff like that, instead of just throwing up a chart that shows a big decline when there's you know, the fishery is, nobody really knows what's going on. We see a lot of fish, they don't gill, whatever, you know, we're not really sure. So I'm not saying that, you know, everything's perfect, but I wish they would qualify it when they show that sharp decline, why it, you know, there's a reason that lends itself to that. That's about all I have. I'll fill up my card and turn it in a minute. Thank you very much.
Mr. Genovese. We have one more public speaker, but Mr. Genovese made a comment that I need to respond to make sure everyone understands. The commission has full authority and does so all the time to take agenda items out of order. And we do this all the time. So those of you who are in the room and those of you who are listening and watching us on the web, please be advised that simply because you have an agenda item that looks like it's got a number of them in front of it, you may not be here when we discuss it if you arrive later on in the day, because for reasons that are technical or relate to the commission's business, we may have to take it first or way before you think. So just make sure you understand that if your item is to be discussed during a day, you probably ought to be there at the beginning.
Mr. President, on the way in today, because of the rain, I heard on the radio there are several wrecks, and some of the people, I know that there's more than one speaker. I saw Ernie come in. He's filling out a speaker card as well. So I think that we got to take that into consideration.
Oh, yes, sir. I can entirely agree with that. I was just kind of trying to make a more expectational point for people.
So it sounds like we have three more speaker cards. Dennis Deaver. Yeah, Ernie. Ernie, I can't read your writing. What's your last name? I'm sorry.
Kepf.
How do you spell that, Ernie?
K-O-E-P-F.
Then Dan Yoakum, then Dennis Deaver.
I sort of hastily scrawled it. I had an automobile breakdown in the rain. All was well.
Kathy, good morning. Good to see you.
Good morning. My name's Ernie Kepf. I'm a commercial herring fisherman and chairman of the Director's Herring Advisory Committee. I banged out a statement yesterday and a presentation, and I'll read from that text. But before I do, I'd just like to, you know, since I haven't see, I'm not familiar with a lot of you folks here. I haven't been for a couple of years. I just want to show you kind of a little bit about what herring fishing is. And I do some field trips for grade school kids to show them how, you know, we fish for herring in the bay. And the first thing I'd like to say is mostly what we do in San Francisco Bay is we drive around and look at fish that enter the bay. And they look like this. This is what we look at about 90% of the time.
If you're going to hand something, it needs to be handed to Sherry, who can then hand it to us.
Okay. So we drive around. The schools enter the bay, and are in the deep, and we follow them. And at a certain point in time, they go into spawn and they go into the shallows, and that's when we catch them. Sam, if you could assist me here a moment, thank you. And the gill net works kind of like this. For us, the herring gillnet in San Francisco Bay. The first year back to the bay to spawn, two-year-olds come to our gear and they go through it. And they spawn and then they go back out in the ocean and they come back the next year as three-year-olds. They come to the gear and they go through it and they spawn and then they go back to sea, and they come back the next year as four-year-olds. And four-year-olds, they just barely stick. Depending on the girth of the fish and the health of the fish and whatnot, they stick. And the same with the five-year-olds. Five-year-olds hit the gear, and away we go. So predominantly it's fours and fives that we're catching. And that's really dependent upon the girth of the fish. The other fish in the bay, the larger fish, the gillnet's really not suitable for them, along with marine mammals. Marine mammals have a tendency to do that immediately. There's no, it's a clean fishery. The gear's in the water about 10% of the season, only when the fish come in.
You need to summarize, sir.
Well, I have a presentation. Could we begin it?
I'm sorry, you don't have time ceded to you. You weren't here, I guess, when we set out the ground rules.
Well, I wasn't here when you set out the ground rules, but I've been here about 30 years, and it seems like there's some pretty serious issues in front of the commission regarding the fishery. One for sure is if I'm not allowed to show the PowerPoint presentation, is that what I'm to understand?
Yes, that is.
Okay. The advisory committee has some serious issues with the methodology of conducting the spawn assessment in San Francisco Bay. The hydroacoustic methodology was discontinued some years ago, and it is proven to be the most accurate way of assessing a biomass. So it is with that in mind that I say to the commission that the biomass estimate for San Francisco Bay last year, anecdotally, was probably about 45,000 tons, and the year before it was about 85,000 tons. We see this on our machines, and we conducted an independent audit, which I'll hand to Sherry to pass to you now.
When you're finished, hand, go okay. ahead. Okay. We will review it.
Okay, good. This biomass estimate is key to setting the season for San Francisco, and even though we don't get the quota because there aren't enough participants, we need that quota. We need the buyers to know that there is a fishery here. They come from Canada. They come from Washington. It costs them a lot of money to set up shop down here. And this year is only going to be probably handling the production of about 20 boats. I would urge the commission to retain their power to set the quotas and the seasons, not give it over to the director as the department has proposed. And I would like the commission to consider the adoption of a 4,500 ton quota for the upcoming season, which is the same as last year.
Thank you. Let me also let you know, if you want to leave your PowerPoint presentation, we can distribute that to the commissioners so they could have it in the record, even though you don't present it, if you want to leave the file.
And let me make another comment. The commission is always interested in receiving PowerPoint presentations. People who do come to us, as you say, you haven't been here very frequently. People who come to us know that if you just warn us beforehand and get the PowerPoint in, we can make adjustments in our time frame, and quite often we can do that, depending upon the amount of time required. So we need to know about these things when you're coming in. So thank you. Just so you know.
Sure. And with that, I'd just like to say that the fishery in San Francisco is a valuable cultural asset and should continue in its reduced fishery from what it used to be, and that's due to economic reasons. The heydays of the 80s and 90s are over. The Japanese economy collapsed. In 1998, it was $2,300 a ton. It's down to about $450 a ton and has been there for about 5 years. About 20 people show up. The fishery has returned to the minor winter fishery that it historically has been. The boom days are over because the economics are not there, but the fishery is still in place, and the resource is still robust, contrary to what you may be hearing from department spawn deposition efforts.
Thank you, Mr. Cobb. We have received several more speaker cards. How many do we have now?
We have three.
We have three more.
Three more. Dan Yoakum, followed by Dennis Deaver, followed by Zeke Grader.
Good morning, Commissioners. Dan Yoakum, Herring Rowan Kelp Advisor. Well, my main concern is the spawn survey estimate.
Could you stand just a little closer to the microphone, sir?
Yeah, the spawn survey estimate not being as accurate as I would like to see it being all the time, and the equipment that is being used. And one of my primary concern is the net, the troll net that they sample the fish with, is that net has not been sufficient for years. We brought it up at meetings over and over and over for years. And
in what respect is it not sufficient?
In the respect that it doesn't go deep enough. It won't hit past 50 feet, which I'm not sure how wide this room is, but this room's probably about 40 feet. So it only goes down another 10 feet below the width of this room, which is weenus as far as trolling or making a sample. It has four doors on it, and it tends to fly instead of diving down. You know, and as fishermen, you know, draggers can get, you know, well past 150 fathoms, which is a lot further than that. So this net has never been set up right. And we allocated money to get a new boat. They had problems with the boat, but the net was one of the main concerns, and that was never addressed. They kept the same net. And the reason that is important is to not only see what fish had spawned, that's a spawn survey, an egg estimate, but it's not estimating what's in the bay, so you can see what comes in the bay, and you can go, okay, there was so many fish in the bay, we netted them here and there at the high tides, so we're saying those are herring. And then you go estimate where they spawned at, and so that you match the two together. And so if your spawn survey, your egg survey, came out really small, and you were missing a lot of what you were seeing in the bay by your sampling of the net, well, you'd go, well, maybe we missed some of the eggs being laid somewhere. You know, as Sam was saying earlier, out in the deeps or various different places, way in the South Bay where hardly anybody goes, it's hard to find them. And so I see that as one of the biggest problems with this estimate of really how many fish there is in there. That net is definitely insufficient. It will not hit 50 feet. At the end of the season, I fished last year. We didn't fish the last 2 years prior to that because our market was had failed on us, but it started coming back as a kelp fishery last year, and I'm going to fish this year. I have a market. And at the end of the season, everybody was gone. The gill netters had left. I was fishing there. And I saw a large amount of fish gathering between the gate and Alcatraz and Sausalito over to Fisherman's Wharf. Now, I asked them several times to dip into that to make sure just what they were. Were they a mix of sardines, anchovies, and how much and what the percentage was? And they dipped into it a couple times. They got it when it came up high enough back by Paradise, and it was a lot herring. They were saying, oh, it was herring, and there was a little bit of older class herring in it. And then when the spawn happened, they registered it as a very small spawn as far as the egg mass. But there was that was the largest body of fish I saw all year right then.
You need to summarize, Mr. Yoko.
Okay, so what I'm getting at is that I don't think they registered all the fish that it came in the bay, plain and simple.
Thank you, sir.
And that I think the quota should be left at last year's standards.
Thank you. Dennis Deaver, followed by Zeke Grader.
Hello, my name is Dennis Deaver. I'm on the Director's Herring Advisory Committee. And I've been fishing herring in San Francisco and Tamales Bay since 1972. I helped pioneer the fishery when it first started. Had a little lapse there and been gill netting back in San Francisco since 85. I also own the Berkeley Marina Sport Fishing Center, the live bait dock, so I'm in the sport fishing end of things. I've run charter boat here, and I fish in Alaska. I have several boats up there, salmon, crab, herring, and such. So I bring a wealth of years of experience to this. And being involved in this fishery, I'm not to say from repeating a lot what everybody else said. I just wanted to add a couple things. When you look at statistic numbers of what this fishery did years ago versus what it does now, you've heard that there's a very lack of participants. We used to have 400 boats on the bay fishing one net apiece. Now we're down to 20 boats fishing two nets apiece. You can't compare the catch numbers from years past to what is being caught today. We can't catch it. Sam brought up the issue about sea lions. When you have 400 nets out there, the sea lions are somewhat dispersed. When you have 40 nets out there, these sea lions are concentrated. They eat a large concentration of fish. There's times we're in the fish, they're eating the fish out of our nets faster than we can produce them. We have to leave areas that we used to be able to catch fish in. So our numbers are going to be quite obscured from what they were in the past. We're restricted from different areas now due to closures like Hunter's Point and places like that that we used to catch fish. Last year, I saw a spawn going on in Hunter's Point. I reported it. Biology staff, they didn't have the people to go down and check it out. It was never documented. After the season, you heard Dan talking about a spawn. Our head biologist Ryan wanted to come out. I still had a boat in the water after the season. We were going to go out and monitor that school of fish, and it was quite large. He had to get the CEQA document done and called me the evening before we were going to go out and look at this fish and record it. And I still had a net on the boat. We were going to drop a net and take some samples. He had to cancel because of paperwork restraints. So with the staffing, with the lack of boats, the numbers that you see now are quite a bit different than what they used to be years ago. There used to be a biology staff that was out there all the time on the water, and even an enforcement staff that isn't there quite as much. But recognize this, Mr. Kellogg helped years ago to get some stuff done with the advisory committee. Last year we had a huge biomass recording. We could have had a monster quota. The advisory committee voted to have that quota cut in half. We are the stewards of our own fishery here, and we have been controlling it quite well. There's only a small amount of participants in it. A fair amount of us are on the advisory committee, and we're going to make sure, like Sam said, we have a large investment in keeping this fishery going. And we are not going to, if we think there's a problem, we're going to recommend to you that you shut it down. You don't need to have anybody else come in here, or we're going to just back off ourselves, because we don't want to see this fishery go away. And to keep buyers coming down, we have to have, like Ernie said, a certain amount of quota to be able to encourage the buyers. We might only have one buyer this year. Last year we had two. In years past, we've had as many as 7 and 8. And there is a lack of boats, and 20 boats are not going to wipe out a fishery and such. We still have not understood, the biologists don't understand quite why the fish are smaller than they used to be. I'm one of the leading guys. I've been on this advisory committee for over 10 years. I've been fighting for the net size when we changed the net size back in 97, which also threw off a lot of the numbers, because now you're comparing a larger net on smaller fish to what we used to catch with a smaller fish, or a smaller net, excuse me, on bigger fish. And like I say, trying to compare statistics, which most people look at, is obscured when you're not comparing apples to apples.
I understand. Could you summarize, Mr. Deaver?
So anyway, like I say, we would like the quota to remain at the 4,500-ton level and keep it in the hands of between the biological staff and the advisory committee, making recommendations to the commission in the future.
Thank you, Mr. Deaver.
Thank you.
Our last speaker card on this issue is Zeke Grader.
Thank you, President Rogers and members of the commission. For the record, my name is Zeke Grader, and I'm the executive director for the Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Associations. I've personally been involved in this fishery, the herring roe fishery, since its beginnings back in 1970. In fact, I ran a fish dock in Sausalito where we received and handled some of the first herring, even before there was any sort of regulation whatsoever. And watched at that time as the fishery began to grow, primarily because of the big Japanese demand at that time for herring roe. I was also present when Senator Baer offered the first legislation to give this commission authority over the fishery to develop regulations and develop its quota. And I think that's important, because prior to that, as with most of our commercial fishery laws still, most of that's retained by the legislature. And this was really the first change, other than the anchovy quota, where they delegated to the commission this authority. And the reason for that was the commission provided a more flexible means than the legislature of overseeing this, also because it provided a public forum for people to come and discuss the issues and for there to be a public airing on that, as opposed to delegating the authority simply to the director of the department to make the regulation. So I think that's important. So my first recommendation here is that it's absolutely critical, I think, that this commission retain its authority to regulate this fishery, and that includes setting the annual quotas. It's absolutely important that people have this opportunity for public input so that you can hear this, so there is a chance for public hearing. Secondly, we've been involved in ever since our establishment of our federation in 76 in a lot of the legislation involved in this fishery, including the taxes on the catches to make sure that there was money for fishing game research. We put together the work on the first fishing game limited entry, first limited entry for this fishery, and also the herring stamp, again, to make sure that there was adequate money for funding for research. I think some of that work, and I think some of the early good work of the department, has been recognized nationally. When the National Research Council recognized this herring fishery, this California herring roe fishery, as one of the best managed in the world. And that wasn't that long ago. And I think we have been doing things right, but the herring fishery has changed mostly because of the markets. The markets in Japan has declined because they now have access to herring from Russia and China, which they did not have when this fishery started. The Japanese economy has went through a terrible depression, and finally, the change has occurred in the Japanese taste. But I think this fishery is still viable, and it's something that we need to maintain, because I think eventually we're going to see it go from a herring roe probably more to a food fish fishery. We're already seeing the inclinations now with squid and sardines finding a way into the finest white table restaurants. I don't think it's very long before we're going to start seeing a big push for this herring to go the same way. So I think it's important that we save it. I would urge this commission to maintain the 4,500-ton limit or the quota that we have, but in additionally to this, so we're not in the same debate every year, you now have reinstituted your Marine Resources Committee. I think this is something that should be taken a look by the committee this year to take a look specifically at, one, do we have adequate funding? How can we properly fund this fishery? And second, to take a hard look at the research that's going on, because I think there are some really credible questions that have been raised about the adequacy of the research. How can we improve it? How can we bring back the hydroacoustics? So we need to do that. So I think it's not just what we do here today, but also I would point this commission during the course of this next year for the Marine Resources Committee to figure out what we can do to greatly improve it. And thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Grady. Hold there just for a moment. Commissioner Sutton.
Thanks, Zeke, for that, and all of you for the very informative background. Do you know, Zeke, if this fishery's ever been, you ever considered getting this fishery certified by the Marine Stewardship Council?
I don't think there's been much inclination to going to MRC, and of course, you know, as you know, the MRC is a little bit controversial right now, even among some of our salmon fishermen and that, but I think that's going to get resolved. But I think that the reason that people haven't really looked at it is simply because the Japanese, it was solely going to Japan. Japan was not seen as being a big community that was that concerned with certification sustainability. I think it would make a lot of sense to go to MRC sustainability, particularly if we begin moving away from the Japanese market more to a domestic food fish market. Then in that case, I think it'd make a great deal of sense. And I think this fishery could be fairly early, easily certified.
Well, I know that at least one herring fishery in Europe is currently undergoing assessment now, and as you know, the Dutch eat something like 25 different kinds of marinated herring, so there's a potential market other than in Asia.
Well, I think it's a wonderful source. I mean, this is the type of thing that we should be putting in our school lunch programs as opposed to the garbage that these kids are eating now. You know, I mean, they might finally be healthy and behave better if they were eating more herring. So, in any way,
Mr. Grader, I must tell you, I must tell you something right now, and it's important for me to insert this.
Sure.
I have always been wildly entertained by your presentations, and informed by your presentations. And until that moment, your normal verbal pyrotechnics had not been there. You're back on track. Good.
Thank you. I had my fish for breakfast this morning.
There you go.
My omega-3s are running through. Thank you.
No.
The answer is yes to Mr. Sutton's question about clarification.
Thank you. Okay, we have no more speaker cards and questions and comments from the commission.
Well, now it's my turn.
Yes. I also the department is
first of all, I want to say that this fishery has improved tremendously since it was more than a couple years ago. It was a few years back when the department come to us and wanted to shut this fishery down. And I have to say that Secretary Chrisman was on this commission and chairing the meeting at the time. And we challenged the department decision, and it ended up that we were right, and the department actually had mud on their face over what they attempted to do, because the next year they had a bigger biomass of herring than they've ever had since the records have been kept. So that was not the right decision to make at that time. And I want to say that Director Broderick weighed in when he became director and engaged himself into this. And at that time, there were some people with the department that had an agenda of their own, I believe, and they were recommending who sat on that herring advisory board to the director and putting people on there that had that same agenda in mind. And Director Broderick came in and made the necessary changes, and I believe that that advisory board and the department have worked well together since then. I really do. I don't think that anybody understands the biomass on herring after all these years, the fishermen included. I don't think anybody understands it. I think that getting a new boat and doing things different than they were doing before shows that the two groups are working very well together today compared to what they were when we had the battle a few years ago. And I think at some point, as they work together, they're going to find a way to count that biomass even better than like they're asking about today. And so I'm not worried about that as long as we. What I'm worried about, and I'm really not worried about the numbers today. I'm worried about, and I can't believe, and I know, and I'm not blaming you, Maria. I can't believe the department even brought this proposal after all we've been through. To give the director, whoever it's going to be. And I love John as much as I did Ryan, but I wouldn't have wanted Ryan to have that authority, even as good as he was. I think you said that it's going to take a workload off the department and this commission. This commission, as far as I'm concerned, can handle the workload that they need to have us make that decision. I think the quotas can be determined between the advisory committee and the department like they should be, and the recommendations can come to us from the department through that vehicle. The biggest problem I got is making the change to give the director that authority, and I think that that's a huge mistake on the department's part to even recommend that. These fishermen are going to do what's right. They're not going to destroy, and that's what I've said from all the fishery issues that we have. The fishermen that have been doing it for their livelihood for generation after generation are not going to destroy or be a part of us destroying their own livelihood. They are the ones that have come forward in the past. They haven't caught their quota for quite some time now. So right now, that quota thing's not the big issue to me. It's the issue of changing who's given the director. And John, if you end up being the director, you can hold this against me forever, but I don't want you to have that authority. I want this commission to have that authority. So,
I appreciate that, Mr. Keller.
But I really truly believe that it's improved a whole bunch since those years when they tried to shut it down. And if we was to approve this proposal today and give the director the authority, we could end up with this fishery being shut down and us not being able to stop it in the future. And I'm not going there. I'm not willing to go there as one commissioner on this commission.
Are there any further comments? Commissioner Gustafson. We also have the department wants to say a few things as well.
Okay, I'll listen first.
You want to wait?
Then I'll ask, sure.
Okay. Sonke? Or Maria?
Maria Boykovich will give us some of the rest of the story here.
Thank you, Commissioners. I'm going to separate this into two separate issues. The one is the science on the quota, and the other is the authority issue. And I just wanted to set the record straight about the science portion. The department is still using the same techniques, survey, spawn estimate techniques that we've been using all along. It has been peer-reviewed science, independent peer-reviewed science. It is the same technique that's being used in the British Columbia fishery. So the science portion of it, we can't move from. Other people here in the audience, the fishermen, have a different opinion. Their science, has not been peer reviewed, and so for the science side of things, I think we've been through this a couple of times before, as Commissioner Kellogg mentioned, and we stand by the science. As far as the authority, that is totally up to you. You have valid reasons, and I do want to say, Commissioner Kellogg, we appreciate the fact that you recognize how hard we've worked with the herring industry and how we have really built that stronger relationship.
And I understand the fishery question and the science, but I'm fine with the science. That's the best we got right now. If we can find better down the road, then we can visit it then. But I'm not fine with that authority part.
Commissioner Gustafson?
I just had a question on the Director's Advisory Committee. When were they presented with this information?
They were notified in March of this year what the department's recommendation for the quota was going to be and the results of our field work. Mm-hmm. And the document has been available for quite a while now.
Right. We've gone through a couple of hearings, and I'm not in disagreement with Commissioner Kellogg. I just I want to make a point here. It is the last, we've been through a 90-day process on this, and it sounds like they've had some time before that to hear some of these issues. And in fact, one of the letters we received from one of the individuals today earlier had said he was supportive of the director's view. So I just want to a little bit defend the department that it sounds like the herring group got back together and changed their position, which is totally understandable, but I don't want, I think Maria did bring this to us. I remember talking about this in Bridgeport and in Santa Barbara, and this was a change that the department was proposing, actually just to try again to streamline and save some funding in how we go about this process, if it wasn't controversial. But I do want to make sure that the Herring Advisory Committee is heard and maybe takes officials' positions on this earlier in the process in the future so that it isn't the last day and we're right here before the season and not ready to go. But I'll support Commissioner Kellogg on this and his approach on the directorate leaving the authority with the commission.
Commissioner Sutton?
Maria, as you know, this is not the first fishery where the fishermen simply don't believe the science or don't support it for whatever reason. They have their own opinion about the biomass that's out there and so forth. But that's one of the reasons there's a trend in this country toward collaborative research that puts scientists together with fishermen. Is this a candidate for that, or is that something that you all are engaged in?
Thank you, Commissioner Sutton. The department does work closely with the industry, and we rely on the industry to give us information that they have in the field so that we can go in and actually sample in the areas that they indicate that there's spawn taking place. So we do work with them. Can there be improvement and more collaboration? Of course. So, we've got this relationship that's more solid than it's been in the past. The department's staffing levels, have been reduced in some instances, or staff have been directed on other projects. So that need exists for us to actually engage more in collaboration.
I have a question on the science side, actually. Commissioner Sutton just asked what I was going to ask, but I have another question for you. Two things were brought up on the science side. Well, there are actually more than that, but two that I want to ask you about. One was the net that is currently being used by us, the 50-foot depth. And then the other question is the use of hydroacoustics. And for those of us who hunt fish, and I'm one of those guys from the sports side, I've seen displays on my both side scanning sonar and my fish finders that looked exactly like the ones that were passed around here. And of course, they could be schools of squid, or it could be all kinds of things. In the science procedure that we use for estimating biomass, do we use those methodologies? And would it be possible, is it possible that the net is not appropriate and could be improved?
Thank you, Commissioner Rogers. The net that's used, the trawl net that was referred to, is used to get the population biology part of the equation, not the spawn part. We found it to be extremely effective in getting what we need out of what's in the area.
As opposed to a different biomass indicator.
Yes. It's a different. We're looking for different things when we use that particular tool. Right. Relative to the hydroacoustic survey, we did used to use that as a kind of a backup or corroborating technique for our spawning survey. That also was peer-reviewed several years ago and found to consistently overestimate the population, so we've discontinued that.
Well, it's also, as was pointed out by one of the speakers, very difficult to see on sonar the difference between a herring, an anchovy, and a sardine. I don't think it's possible. So, yeah. Okay. Thank you. Any further questions or comments? Sankey, do you want to weigh in on this?
The only thank you, Maria. She did a very good job of highlighting the key points. I do want to clarify, I think there's, and I understand why it's being misconstrued. As you heard from the fishermen, and you've heard from us on various venues, staffing is an issue, and one of our goals is to put our scientists assigned to the Herring Project in the water, on the water, as much as possible. Unfortunately, this fishery is very heavy on process in terms of regulatory packages and EIRs. And so the department, working with the commission staff, was looking at ways to try and reduce the amount of time our biologists have to spend writing ISORs and EIRs and get them in the field. And for example, every year in the herring fisheries, the specific date and year is specified when the season starts, which means every year we have to process a regulatory package just to deal with a calendar shift. So our goal was to try and get us out, or get our herring biologist out of process and into biology, by essentially saying the director could set those dates through a memo by presenting to the commission and avoid all the other paperwork, because something as simply as dealing with a calendar shift.
I understand, Sankey.
So that was the intent. That was our intent, simply to try and...
I understand. Let me ask you a very specific question then, because this is a main theme that I'm picking up both from my fellow commissioners and from those who are speaking, is the concern that a collaborative process between both the herring fishermen and the department, and then, of course, with the commission weighing in and being a court of last resort, in a sense. We wouldn't want to think of it that way, but maybe an initial court as well. In some way, that would be broken down by this. Could you very specifically discuss that,
yes,
that nexus of control? Because I think it is very important, as Commissioner Kellogg said and Commissioner Gustafson confirmed, that we don't allow that to break down. That
right.
that's an important thing. And if anything, we need to expand that kind of interaction with one another in the future, while, of course, trying to reduce the dreaded paperwork problem.
Yes, I can, Commissioner Rogers. What's currently, the department staff works through the DHAC, and director is the head chair on the DHAC, well before May. We work collaboratively during the herring season, collect data. As Maria pointed out, they tell us where the herring are. We go do our biology, vice versa. It's a very collaborative process in the field. We take all that data, we do our science to it, and we meet with the DHAC and say, here's what we saw, and here's what we're recommending. We work through the DHAC, as Maria, as early as March, I believe it is, through the process. That the, what we were proposing is, and the director, of course, submits an ISOR to you currently as a recommendation. You're not giving up any authority. What I would argue is we work, again, with the DHAC and the Herring Fishermen collaboratively, as always, to come up with a recommendation, as we always have. The only change is the form, and that form, instead of an ISOR, is a memo. The commission has every right, after May, if they take testimony through a noticed hearing, do not like what they're seeing or want something, they can ask the director to change the recommendation in the memo. And if the director is unresponsive for some bizarre reason, you can go to rulemaking and still have plenty of time to use your authority to change the quota. This is not really handing over the authority. You're letting the director do business a little differently. You still retain the right through the regulatory process to change everything here that's not
That encapsulates what I thought I had read with respect to the documents that were submitted to us. Are any of my other commissioners comfortable or uncomfortable with what Sankey said, or how would that, how would maintaining the current status quo and doing an ISOR, therefore, differ in your own minds? I'm having some trouble getting there. Help me, please.
Well, that's because you weren't here in that first round.
Yeah, I agree.
That could very easily turn back around to where the people, if we had the same situation, okay, and that's nothing against the people that are doing this today, but in those days, I'm convinced, and that's what makes me hesitant about all these other issues we deal with. If somebody out there somewhere that I can't see has got their own agenda, and in those days somebody had an agenda. The people that had that agenda to shut that herring fishery down were recommending who was on the director's advisory board, and they took people that had been doing the fishery their entire careers off that advisory board and put people who had the same thought train they had on the advisory board.
That actually did happen
that,
in the past.
If I want, you want me to keep going, that
please.
Yeah. That's where this could end up going again if all the wrong people were in the wrong place.
Yeah, may I point out that anyone who is speaking from the audience is degrading their case. Please be quiet. Thank you.
Anyway, I just don't want this fishery to end up back where it was then, and I think this gives it a vehicle to do that.
Okay. Thank you. Any further comments from the commissioners or questions? Commissioner Gustafson.
You know, I find myself in the middle here quite often, it seems, in which, you know, I hear the merits of the department's case, but I hear the issue of trust. And in the public domain, quite often what we're dealing with is truly not the science or sometimes what's most efficient, but what is right for public process. And that's why I find myself at this point in time suggesting that we support Commissioner Kellogg in this issue, and allow some further trust to develop and maybe come back with this and consider these changes again in the future, once maybe we've established a longer-term relationship here, and make sure that the Director's Advisory Committee is honored, the membership is representative of the fishing community, and politics aren't played at that level.
Thank you, Commissioner Gustafson. Any further questions or comments? John, do you have a motion to tee up?
Well, first, we need to certify the document, so a suggested motion from staff, the environmental document to certify it would be Fish and Game Commission hereby certifies that the final environmental document on Pacific Herring has been completed in compliance with the California Environmental Quality Act, in that it was presented to the commission, and that the commission has reviewed and considered the information contained in the final environmental document prior to approving the project. Certified environmental document provides that there are no significant adverse environmental impacts resulting from the proposed project. And the commission finds that on the basis of the facts and the record that the environmental document, that the proposed project and the alternatives will have no significant adverse impact.
John's microphone, once again, is not picking things up particularly well for some reason. Thank you. Okay. Do I hear a motion?
For approving that.
Just for that one motion, just to approve the adoption.
Okay, because the second motion is going to include
understand.
Just, I'll make that motion.
Do I hear a second?
Second.
Is there any discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Unanimous. Okay, John, number two.
A suggested motion by staff is Fish and Game Commission, pursuant to Section 21080.5 of the Public Resources Code, hereby adopts the proposed project and any alternative stated by the commissioners for the proposed regulatory action relating to the Sections 163 and 164, Title 14, related to herring. Further, the commission directs staff to prepare a notice of determination consistent with approval and adoption of associated regulations. So where we would need some suggestion from the commission on this motion is any type of alternatives that they would want to go with.
Okay, do I hear that motion or an alternative from a commissioner?
I'll accept that motion with the exception of the recommendation that the quotas be set by the director, that recommendation be removed from the department's recommendation, and accept all other recommendations except that one in the motion.
And John, that is the appropriate price for that alternative? Yes. Do I hear a second?
Yes, I'll second that.
Any discussion?
Folks, yeah. You made on the quota.
Speak a little bit closer to your microphone, John, would you please?
You'd indicated a concern with the quota, also the date. No?
No,
just the quota.
The quota was not raised as an issue in that motion.
No, relative to the director's authority, making sure that the authority, as described in the paperwork, relates to both the date of the fishery and
the date and the quota. Both.
Quota, right.
Yes. Okay. Yes. Okay. Does everyone understand that explanation from John? Okay. So it's been moved and seconded. Is there any discussion? I think we need a roll call.
Roll call. President Rogers?
Aye.
Vice President Gustafson?
Aye.
Commissioner Kellogg?
Aye.
Commissioner Sutton?
Aye.
That is unanimous. Thank you. Thank you all for coming on this issue. Number 21. Oh, no, excuse me. We have... it's combined. That's right. Number 21.
Item 21, receipt of public testimony on proposed changes to Section 251.3, Title 14, related to prohibition against feeding big game mammals. Please note that the adoption hearing is scheduled for November 2nd, 2007 in Sacramento. From the department.
The commission will break for 10 minutes, and we will reconvene at 10 after 10. There? Nope. We need to reconvene. Could those who are outside, if we can get somebody. Roland, could you just let everybody in? Thank you, sir.
Okay.
Is that where he is?
I'm just trying to help Richard get out of here. He's got a I'm hoping not.
Snowing on the ridge.
Well, I might have to stop in Roosevelt and shop.
There you go.
When you live in Tahoe, you have to take those opportunities to go to real department stores where you can buy the things that...
Dang, that was oh, I see how I rank.
Undergarments. You can't necessarily go in Tahoe.
Probably
cannot need anymore.
There's no
Victoria.
Oh, God. You know, they said it was going to be 7,000 feet, but
yeah, I've heard
it's dropped.
They can come on Wednesday.
They can come on Wednesday.
Oh, you're
going to
need
to do I can make it through. Remember, I spent a lot of years in Minnesota. I have my height.
Minnesota.
Minnesota. No.
Okay, the commission is back in session. John Carlson has a slight alteration of procedure. We have to define something a little bit.
Yeah, I apologize, commissioners, but I missed a key detail in that last motion, so we want to do one additional motion to clarify, and this is suggested from staff, a motion to clarify that the commission sets the quota at 10% of biomass for San Francisco Bay, which is as recommended by the department, but that needs to be clarified. So I'm sorry, that's a suggested motion. We need one more vote on that.
Mr. Kellogg, do you want to?
So move.
Second.
Any discussion?
No.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
That's unanimous. Thank you. Okay, item 21.
So back to item 21, receipt of public testimony on proposed changes to section 251.3, title 14. Related to prohibition against feeding big game mammals. As I mentioned, the adoption hearing is scheduled for November 2nd in Sacramento. Speaking for the department on this issue, Sonke or Nancy?
Yeah, I'll really highlight. This, again, is to change a procedure in the big game feeding regulations. Previously, the regional manager had to send a warning letter. We're striking that and so that offenders can be either cited or warned directly. As you are well aware with the Tahoe bear situation, feeding is becoming a real problem, and we've got individuals who are blatantly violating the law. We just need to strengthen the tool here so we can get them to stop, because they're causing all kinds of problems.
Thank you, Sonke. Any questions from the... We do have one public speaker. Any questions from the commission? Okay.
Virginia Handley. And Ms. Handley asked if she could speak a little bit about legislation from yesterday. She missed that item. If you want to fold that in right now, it would be after you comment on this.
Well, I wanted to hear the report about the legislation.
Oh, that happened yesterday.
So you're going to have to get that off.
You were going to put it off. You told me you were
putting
it off.
Oh, no. I'm sorry. We went through that.
There was actually done yesterday.
There was a written one turned in by the department.
Yeah, I would love to.
You can get a copy of that.
I would love to see that. And I can go back and get my...
Okay, please go ahead, Virginia.
My list.
Good morning, Virginia.
You want me to do this? You want me to do that right now?
I'm sorry, do what right now?
Well, I need to get my list of legislation if I'm going to speak about it.
No, why don't you go ahead with item 21.
Okay.
And we'll see if the chair will allow it later. Testimony.
Well, thank you, Commissioners. Virginia Hanley, Animal Switchboard. I'm not in opposition to this change. I understand the department's frustration and wanting to eliminate the warning. Sankey did mention the Lake Tahoe bears, and it's a well-meaning effort to try to get the bears back out into the woods, and what the bears have had to go through with the fire and the drought, and they really it becomes a public safety matter too when these bears are coming too close to where the people are. So I can understand that frustration too, in an effort to try to help the bears and also try to deal with the public safety issue. And I don't know if there's any exception. Is it ever considered an alternative or something to do, or that something that should be done, or is it just a absolute blanket prohibition, or can any exceptions ever be made? Because sometimes maybe that is an alternative of something to do. And this is limited to the big game mammals, but that means people feeding deer, which a lot of times people inadvertently are feeding wild animals. They throw an apple out their back window, you know, and some wildlife is gonna eat it. But that was just my concern of can there ever be an exception made? Is that ever an alternative that one might want to use, maybe the department themselves,
okay.
And if
thank
that's
you,
allowed.
Virginia. Thank you. Sankey, do you want to speak to that issue?
Yes, Commissioners. This prohibition is for the general public to, on their own, just decide to feed wildlife. The scientific record's pretty straightforward across the continental United States on the problems this behavior causes. The department always has the authority to, if a feeding situation were to come up where the department believes it would be a benefit, the department has authority to deal with that. This is just a general provision that the public in general should not be feeding these animals because it has grave consequences.
Yeah, that's my understanding of it too. Are there any comments or questions from any of the commissioners? Commissioner Sutton.
Just a clarification for the department, and forgive my ignorance, but I know in some states big game are baited intentionally and it's legal, but my understanding is that not the case in California?
Yeah, Texas has some peculiar habits.
That is one of the largest statements I think you have ever made.
Yeah. Well, my brother, he moved there a while back, said, "You won't believe this. Baiting's legal here." You know, he was shocked. There are different practices. In this state, baiting is specifically illegal for any wildlife, and feeding is just another form of it.
I guess now fishing is now illegal. No, excuse me.
You had to go there.
That includes putting corn in your duck club, Richard.
Uh-oh.
Yeah.
No, that thing, that field just happened to grow there, but so...
Virginia made a good point. Our law enforcement, and I'll speak for Nancy just for expediency, they have discretion to judge a situation. This is not intended to nail a person that threw the apple core in the backyard and a jay swoops down or deer picks it up. This is for folks who are habitually causing a problem through feeding, and it's a way to a tool to get them to really stop. And that's all it's really intended for.
I understand. Any questions? Yes.
Just a comment. You know, living in Tahoe and our wonderful Tahoe bears and all the folks that are I think, well-intentioned but perhaps misguided in their efforts, I have to support this. We need to send a message to the public that feeding these bears is not helping these bears. And even if they're doing it in the backcountry, they are just condemning more bears to problems in the future. So.
Commissioner Kellogg?
I agree.
Commissioner,
I was going to say something about our bear commissioner, but some people might take that wrong.
Take it away. Very much wrong.
Yeah, they probably would, actually. Don't get me started on that subject. Okay.
May I make one comment on one bill?
No, Virginia, if you would be so kind, please turn it in writing, and we will be.
I was told yesterday specifically that it would come up today.
No, I'm sorry. There must have been a misunderstanding. So anyway, we'll get it if you just. We will get it if you submit it in writing, and we'll be delighted to hear it. Okay, item 22.
Item 22, receipt of public testimony on proposals to amend sections 353 and 475, Title 14, related to methods authorized for taking big game and methods of take for non-game birds and mammals. Please note that this item includes the possible prohibition of the use of lead ammunition for hunting big game, non-game birds, and non-game mammals for the protection of the California condor. An additional discussion hearing is scheduled for November 2nd, 2007 in Sacramento. I also want to alert the commissioners that a draft environmental document on this issue has been placed in front of you today. We received it today, and there's a display copy out front. And if anyone has questions on that, I think the department will talk about how you can access that also. For the department, we have Dr. Eric Loft from the Wildlife Branch to give us a update on where this is at.
Good morning, Eric. Good to see you.
Good morning, President Rogers, Commissioners. Eric Loft with the Wildlife Branch in the department. And just to introduce this topic, got a short little PowerPoint describing where we are today with this agenda item. Sections 353 and 475 of the Code of Regulations are what we're talking about, of course, and have been talking about since this was initiated and discussions last December and formally starting in February of 2007. And of course, this is commonly known as the lead and condor issue. I killed it. What did I just do?
I told you to use a copper presentation.
I'm sorry. Steve, which is the forward button on the... The one that says forward? I hit the black one. Black screen of death. Excuse me. As John Carlson just indicated, commissioners and everyone else, copies are now available of our draft environmental document. It's a recirculated draft of the environmental document. Copies are available from the department at the address of the Wildlife Branch listed on the PowerPoint. And folks can also receive an electronic PDF copy if they send an email to wildlifestrategy@dfg.ca.gov and put in the subject line, and that's all you need to do, just put method of take, and you'll automatically be beamed an electronic copy of the document. Commissioners, just to be sure, and I know that there has been a lot of chaos, if you will, or discussion and events that have happened since we initially released the draft environmental document in February of this year. Over the past 10 months, a lot of events have transpired. But by and large, and Acting Director McCammon basically asked us of this a couple weeks ago. He says, well, what's new and different? Where are we with this thing kind of a question? And by and large, the department's position, and I think I'm happy to report that I think we've been fairly stable, pretty stable in terms of where we are as a department since we issued the first original document in February of 2007. And there are some modifications that have been made to the document, and that's based on the testimony that you folks have received over the past several months. And it's one is the modification of the affected area, the geographic boundary a little bit, and some modification of terminology and definition for projectiles and for what non-lead might mean. And we've added in this document an update of the scientific information and sources of lead. And also working with commission staff, worked on options for the commission to consider on projectile restrictions or exemptions. And some of this came out at the August 27th hearing that you had in Sacramento a couple months ago. Just to be certain, none of the changes in this recirculated draft compared to the first draft result in any significant impact on the environment. So essentially, I'll give you a quick rundown of what the proposed action is. The proposed action prohibits the use of lead projectiles in California condo range for big game hunting and for non-game hunting, with the possible exemption of 22 rimfire and smaller caliber. And in doing in implementing the proposed action, the commission would also need to work on defining projectiles for these regs. That's proposed in the initial statement. You need to work on establishing a maximum level of lead in the projectiles. That is, how much lead can actually be in a lead bullet, if you will.
Or even in a copper one, for that matter.
Yes, in a copper one, exactly. And the commission would need to establish what is the geographic area, the geographic footprint of a restriction, and establish also that it would be unlawful to possess a projectile that contains lead or a firearm to use that lead bullet while you're hunting for these particular species. And again, the option to exempt the 22 caliber rimfire. The map on the lower right is just the geographic area of the proposed project. The proposed action would affect hunting in the Central Coast Range area of the state. And the boundaries that are identified tentatively now are based on the highway systems to reflect as best we can the current condor distribution and using landmarks that are easily detectable on the ground. Looking at what the options are, and we've had this discussion with commission staff, we think there's a couple of issues that perhaps the commission and the department will need some assistance with, and that is to establish this maximum threshold of allowable lead in a projectile. We had initially talked about putting in percentages, and to be perfectly blunt, we were estimating and making guesses. We don't know what the percentages of lead in a copper bullet really are. And that needs to be resolved and figured out over the next couple months.
Eric, you might point out for everyone listening, both on the web and here in this audience, about the metallurgical problem of creating a ostensibly lead-free copper projectile without any trace elements of lead. That is one of the major problems with saying no lead.
Exactly, and that was the comment that Sankey Mastrup made some time ago as well, is that if you say non-lead, that means no lead, and we're of the understanding that there will be trace levels of other elements and even a copper bullet.
Commissioner Sutton?
Well, it's my understanding that non-lead means anything we want it to mean. I mean, that is to say, we define it.
Correct.
And our legal counsel can comment on this, but probably the easiest thing to do is simply create a definition for non-lead or non-toxic that encompasses the ammunition in question.
That is going to be the department's proposal.
Exactly.
I just wanted everyone out there to understand that even what looks like a perfectly pure copper bullet, we have been advised by the manufacturers of copper that it is virtually impossible to get any trace elements of lead out. The bullet would not be toxic in any manner. Still, there would be a trace element. Anyway, go ahead, Eric.
Exactly. You and Commissioner Sutton are both absolutely right. And that's part of what is in the proposed actions, that the commission would make that definition. The other item that we think is new and different, really, is the option to exempt the 22 caliber rimfire and smaller cartridges from this proposed regulation. The alternatives that are considered, commissioners, alternative one, no change in the regulation, and that's essentially a no action alternative. The alternative two is taking that proposed action and applying it to what is considered the historic or potential range of the California condor. So that includes the proposed range on that one map and also the southern Sierra Nevada. Alternative three is taking the proposed action to prohibit lead and applying that statewide, simply that. Alternative four is a new one. And what that does, there's an option there for the commission to adopt and maintain the existing regulations but require disposal of the remains of a game mammal shot. And alternative five is merely another option that we needed to plug in that was available to you and listed as an alternative here. It doesn't describe as an alternative necessarily. It isn't an alternative in the eyesore, excuse me. But it's a proposed project, implementing the proposed project, but also allowing lead projectiles in these obsolete or wildcat cartridges that are made by machinists and custom applications that may or may not be available commercially. So just real quickly, alternative two would affect the hunting in this geographic area state. It includes the proposed area plus those deer zones. It's a little different in that alternative two, we would totally make the recommendation that its boundaries are defined by deer zones entirely rather than the highways of the proposed action. So that's what the darker lines are all the deer zones that are affected or would be affected in that proposed action. The green dots on there are the current, or actually those are the historical condor observations that exist that shows where condors used to occur. And the boundaries, again, are based mostly on the primarily on the deer zones, which are recognizable on the ground. And then again, just alternative three is statewide. And so that's just a real quick rundown. I would also suggest or let you know that Dale Steele's here in the audience. Dale is, of course, on the condo recovery team and the lead subcommittee. He may be able to answer any questions if the commission has any regarding that topic. We also have included in the environmental document the recent memo from Acting Director McCammon to the commission. It's pasted into the back of the environmental document in Appendix 4. And as Appendix 4, unfortunately, Appendix 4 doesn't show up at the top to identify it, but it's the last five printed pages of the document is the department's understanding as it currently is of the science on this topic. And that's
thank you, Eric. Are there any questions? We have a number of speaker cards. Bill Cunningham, did you want to have something said here?
Mr. President, members of the Commission, Bill Cunningham and Deputy Attorney General, Counsel for the Commission. The one thing I wanted to also perhaps have the Commission accept and acknowledge for the record is the fact that to the extent we are now looking at a package that may in part be amended and be recirculated, and to the extent that we have worked with the Office of Administrative Law to in part reinitiate some of our process here, I do think it appropriate that we also go on the record as incorporating for this most recent event all of the prior testimony that has been provided and all of the prior documents and exhibits provided to the Commission on this subject during the entire length of our consideration of this matter. I think that is what the Commission wants. I don't think you want to start this whole thing over again.
No,
with this most
no we certainly
package.
Don't, Bill.
So may I suggest perhaps a cleanup discussion or resolution or motion that would essentially state that for purposes of the consideration of this subject, the Commission's administrative record will include all the comments, written materials, and documents submitted on this matter since the initiation consideration of this subject.
Do I hear a motion from... Yeah, exactly. Bill, you have to clarify the starting date. It was February of...
There are two different starting dates that are possible here. One is from the most recent package, which would be
February 07
of 2007. An alternative would be to go all the way back to the first time we heard discussion of this matter in 2005. Yeah. So it's again, either would work. The 2005 would be more inclusive, but also perhaps almost unwieldily complicated because we have yet to refine what we were doing until.
And it's my understanding that most all of that has been reiterated. In fact, all of it has been reiterated
in 2007.
In 2007, if we pick that as a start date.
So may I have it reflect that we would incorporate all comments, both oral and written, all materials submitted since this matter was initiated in February 2007.
Okay. Any? Do I hear a motion to that effect?
Sure, I'll move that motion.
Do I hear a second?
Second.
Any commentary? All those. Eric, did you have a comment?
Commissioners, just to be consistent, I think I missed that and it escaped me on a slide. The department also would incorporate all those comments that we received on the environmental document in the final environmental document that we would do as well.
That's standard procedure. Yeah, the first iteration you were talking about. Yeah, okay, good. Sankey,
just so I understand, The motion is to include all testimony on the regulatory packages all the way back, so we'd have to bring all those comments forward into this one. Is that what I'm understanding the motion would do?
My understanding would be that this would just reflect that the commission considers it its own administrative record to include all of those materials. And I don't think that that requires much more than that, but it would reflect that those people who've already given us their comments on the prior package in March of 2007 or all the way up through all of the subsequent hearings until today, those materials would be
part of our consideration.
Part of our consideration, okay. Part of our record.
Right.
That's fine. Yeah. Thank
okay.
you.
Okay. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. That's unanimous.
Thank you on behalf of staff.
Okay, now we go to public commentary.
Thank you, President Rogers. Yes, we have a few speaker cards. And the president has set the time at 3 minutes for an individual. If you have anyone who cedes time to you, you get a maximum of 5 minutes, no matter how many cards are ceded to you. We are going to start with Eric Mills, followed by Gary Langham, followed by Anthony Canellis.
Good morning, commissioners.
Good morning, Eric.
Before I begin, I'd like to say a special thank you to Mr. Kellogg for speaking out yesterday about the fish in Oakland. I live on one of those creeks. It'd be nice to see trout there again to expedite that process. It's much appreciated. Thank you for that.
I can't help you protect some of the other people.
I remember that.
Wow.
Back in the early 80s when there were 22 condors in the wild, I went on a field trip to the Ventura Mountains and saw three of them in one morning, one of which flew right over my head. Last year, I saw another three at the Grand Canyon. 2 weeks ago, two in Big Sur. Quite an experience. A lot of effort has gone into saving these birds, and I think it's critical we do everything we can to do so. I say right off the bat, I'm for alternative number three, statewide ban on all lead, including fishing. It's a major problem for a lot of birds, too. I think to exempt the 22s is a major mistake. A lot of other animals out there eat lead or dead animals with lead in them. Coyotes, badgers, crows, vultures, ravens, occasional hunting dog. We know it's a problem. We banned it for waterfowl, 20 years ago now? The world didn't collapse. It's gone out of gasoline, ceramic dishes. There should be a nationwide ban on this stuff. It's just common sense, it seems to me. I just saw a report, written by Jim Matthews in Project Gut Pile. South Dakota banned lead shot ammunition for upland game in 1998. Canada has had a nationwide ban on lead shot since 1999. Last week, this was written in March of this year, Missouri banned lead ammunition in 21 of its conservation areas. And the study found that shorebirds, turkeys, mourning doves, quail, several species of raptors, including bald eagles, were affected. If it's ingested, even one pellet would probably result in incapacitation and death, said the assistant director for the State of Conservation. So there's lots of evidence out there to do the right thing. I'm counting on this commission to do just that. I think they will hold me. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Eric. Next speaker.
Gary Langham, followed by Anthony Canellis, followed by Ed Schultz.
Good morning, Gary Langham, Director of Bird Conservation for Audubon, California, representing 60,000 members. All this rain this morning reminds me of our session in Arcata back in February, and since then there's been quite a few changes to the faces of the commission. But I want to say that I still have faith in this process and still believe in it. And part of the reason I still believe in it is the document we received today. And I would like to say that Audubon supports it, this as written. We think it's really getting down to being practical and getting this done. I'm a big believer that we can have both full condor recovery and maintain hunting. And this is a great step in the right direction. The only thing I might ask is that you consider alternative two, expanding to the historical range, so that we don't have to revisit this in a few years as that successful reintroduction that I'm expecting to happen does happen, just to consider that as a possibility. And I had one question on adding documents to this as well. Were you planning, or does this include, I just seen this, the excellent report from your own scientific advisory committee, Dr. Raisbro and Cynthia Stringfield from the August session, is that going to be included? And if not, I would urge you to do that. I think it's a solid scientific document.
Yeah, so all documents that have been submitted to the commission will be included.
Okay.
In the record, so that it is used during the deliberative process.
Thank you.
Yes. Thank you, Dr. Langley.
Anthony Canales, followed by Ed Schultz, followed by Walt Manziel.
Honored Commissioners, I have a PowerPoint, and I also have some documents like in the past that I've submitted. I was hoping to approach or give them. I want to make sure you get them all. Thank you. You might want to make sure this one is. Administratively, you just want to make sure that first there's a letter from a gentleman by the name of Dexter Haight. You'll see his qualifications on the top part of the letter in regards to safety programs for workers in naval shipbuilding. And you might want to take his concerns into account as regard to inhalation pathways of lead. A second document is courtesy from the Earth Science Environmental Technology Group over at UC Santa Cruz from the year 2000. It's a study by a gentleman by the name of Steen, Dunlap, and Flegel in regards to isotopic measurements that they made back in those days. You might find that document also pertaining to some of your considerations for riparian, riverine, and marine situations as far as lead contamination. And then, of course, the ubiquitous purple envelope is my PowerPoint. See, how do we work this thing? Uh-oh. Okay. So this? No? Okay. So far, both in the testimony and in the letter by the 31 PhDs and numerous other scientists involved or researchers involved, the principal link between lead and ammunition and elevated blood levels in free-flying condors is made through isotopic ratio analysis of lead 207 to lead 206, the Church document. Everybody's been familiar with that by now, I think. Church represents isotopic ratios of blood levels in tested condors, and chart represents figure 1. And he shows measurements of two different brands of ammunition of isotopic ratios in Table 3. I believe the Church is in error in attributing these isotopic ratios in free-flying condors to ammunition only, and I'm going to hopefully show you that. We also have some information in regards to a DTSC, or Department of Toxic Substances Control document from 2004. These show numerous pathways, including inhalation of lead, which I think are being overlooked in the Frye document and subsequent testimony. There was some data that I presented in August. We didn't get to talk about it, but if you go back to the record, you'll see about lead dust ingestion, paint ingestion, that kind of thing, inhalation, that kind of thing. The airborne issue can't be overlooked, especially with what we'll show you today. You can find this report, obviously, at that URL. DTSC shows this number of pathways as possibly affecting individuals in humans, and noticing that the other side is, so to speak, has been talking about children, you know, child levels at 10 micrograms per deciliter, so on and so forth, we thought this was relevant as well. Basically, in a nutshell, especially with the Steen study, the Steen Dunlap Flegel study, the lack of uniqueness of the isotopic ratio as pertaining to lead and ammunition only is now questioned. From here, you'll see this from the Church document. You should all be familiar with it. We discussed it in Bridgeport. Here's Table 3 from the Church document, which shows the actual values that he measured. If you take those actual measures and superimpose them over his chart, you'll see that a number of free-flying condors do not have blood-lead ratios in the ratios that he found for ammunition. From Steen, Dunlap, and Flegel, they found a number of measurements related to various kinds of lead sources in the riverine system that eventually winds up in San Francisco Bay and adversely affects the food chain in San Francisco Bay. They've got runoff from the hills, basically. You've got hydraulic mine sediments and something of like 50, 60 years of legacy lead from combustion and refining and whatnot. And that doesn't include things like paint and other things we know about. So when you do the reciprocal, because the steeding document does it, lead 206 to lead 207, you have to do a reciprocal conversion to get the ratios as to have consistent units with the church document. And notice this range is there. When you take just the fuel combustion, you see the overlay. This is not speaking to concentration. I'll speak of concentration later. You notice that the range of fuel combustion isotopic ratios consumes a large variety or a large amount of the range already in the church document. Add to that the natural runoff and the tailings and residues in creeks and streams, and you'll find that you're no longer dealing with one possible source of isotopic lead contamination condors. You're dealing with additionally three more. And these tend to be soluble more so than the metallic lead alloys, which are reported by DTSC as relatively insoluble. The acid mobilization argument basically hinges on, are there condors out there with 100 degree C body temperatures? Because that's what it takes to basically dissolve metallic lead with hydrochloric acid. Conclusion, it's not unique. You couldn't convict a Tukey Williams with this kind of relationship. In addition, there's a number of point sources throughout the condor range, and these are going to be specifically, these are listed at the DTSC website. These are the URLs. In one case, EPA walked in, circled the place off, and started excavating soil. It was that hot with lead. And that was within 30 miles of Bitter Creek in the Hopper Mountain area. And when it's that hot, you know it's serious. In this particular case, condors have been noted to fly up to 72 miles, so this is well within the range of the Hopper Mountain facility and birds in that range. Conclusion, I believe additional study is warranted. This definite link that is being claimed by the other side does not exist forensically. This is not something that could even make the beginning with a district attorney in a criminal conviction. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Next speaker.
Ed Schultz.
Ed Schultz from Novato.
Hold on a sec, please, sir. Followed by Walt Manziel, followed by Henry Coletto. Thank you.
Okay. Ed Schultz from Novato. What I'm after recommending or requesting is that you put the same restriction on sport hunters in the condor area that you do to the recipients of depredation permits. To me, that's the largest percentage of where we're getting the lead contamination in condors. I'm going to give you a scenario which is not going to be too pleasant, but this is real life. A rancher or farmer gets a depredation permit for vermin enemies, which is deer and pigs. And I'm going to talk about just deer and pigs. Okay, what does he do to get rid of the deer and pigs? He has to meet a requirement of either hanging them, gutting them, or disposing them properly and notifying the officials when it's happened. But they don't do that. What they do is they go out in the evening to the spotlight and they shoot these deer and the pigs with the 22s, as evidence in the one that was shown with the x-ray with the 22 projectiles in it. They use shotguns. And the way they do this, the why they do this, is these animals then will go off and die in a day, 2 days, a week, off their property, so they don't have to deal with it. And to me, that's one of the major sources that the condors are getting is the small lead projectiles, 22s, or lead shot from shotguns in these animals that are used in depredation permits. All I'm asking is that you put the same requirements that you do for hunters, which is going to affect maybe 30,000 hunters, that you do for the 500 plus or minus depredation permits in condor area. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Schultz.
Walt Manziel, followed by Henry Coletto, followed by Dennis Fox.
Good morning, members of the commission. Walt Manziel, representing the California Rifle and Pistol Association. I've spoken on this issue, I think, virtually every time it's been on a commission agenda since that back in 2005 in San Diego in January, I believe.
Yep.
Some of you weren't there, but I've tried not to be real redundant. California Rifle and Pistol Association continues to oppose an outright ban on lead ammunition that does not allow hunters the other options that are expressed in some of the alternatives put before you. We feel very strongly that the educational component has not been used nearly as strongly as it could be, that the burying of gut piles, picking up the disposing of the remains of animals, if that is left a part of some regulation, we could support that. The initial statement that the commission filed with the other agencies involved when you during the regulatory process contained several errors with respect to prices of ammunition. It contains a technical error with respect to using the term explosion for what happens when a projectile is discharged. We applaud the change to the word projectile instead of ball, bullet, and all of that. But explosion is not what happens. Ballistic experts know this. The ammunition manufacturers know this. Modern smokeless rifle and pistol and shotgun powder burns progressively. It is an inflammable, not an explosive. Just a point of information. I have some documents I'll present to you that have a lot of the information. One of the contentions throughout this process have been what is available and what is not available in the ammunition field. We have not talked about what is not available, so I've addressed it from the opposite side. It's in this paper, which I will turn in to Sherry.
Thank you, Will.
The final thing I want to discuss is we have been wrestling over this for a long time, and it's assumed by the proponents, and I have talked to quite a few of the proponents, that you pass some kind of regulation that the issue is solved. They can go back and raise money with their constituents, do whatever. And it's not solved at all. They have no conception of what it takes to make this apply. We heard evidence from Chris in his study in northern Arizona that you need nearly 100% compliance to work. There is no way in the world you will achieve 100% compliance. You will not achieve 90% compliance. No matter how vigorous the law enforcement action is taken with the resources you have at hand, please let us continue with an educational program. Please let us have other options. I'm pleased to see some of the things in the alternatives that Eric presented for wildcat ammunition, for obsolete ammunition. There's a whole cadre of hunters out there that want to hunt with their buffalo rifles from the 1860 era. They're not numerous, but they have their place. And I appreciate the chance to talk to you about this, and I'll turn this to Eddie and to Sherry.
Thank you, Walt. Next speaker.
Henry Coletto, followed by Dennis Fox, followed by Virginia Handley.
Can I get a photograph to the commission?
Please turn it in over here. Thanks.
I'd like to take and say, as you, my name again is Henry Coletto. I'll back up just a minute. As you take and look at this photograph, I'll take and send around to you. I'd like you to just take and remind you that these were three hunters that took and participated on the ecological area that belongs to the Department of Fish and Game. It's managed by the California Deer Association, and they all took and used non-lead ammunition to take their animals. To take and start with, I'd like to take and introduce myself again, Henry Coletto. I was a county fish and game warden for 37 years in Santa Clara County. I've hunted since I was 7 years old. I've worked with wildlife research for over 40 years. I've been in the outdoors all my life. The lead issue may seem complex, but really it is rather simple. Lead is bad in the environment for wildlife and humans. With about 150 condors in the wild, the decision to ban lead in their range is simple. Do the right thing. Get rid of it. We all should be looking long range rather than short range. We need to take a look at a lead-free state. All wildlife is affected by lead, including golden eagles, bald eagles, and even humans. Change is always faced with opposition, but I will tell you that the true hunter is a conservationist and will gladly make the change. The rest will follow and will continue to hunt because it is what they enjoy. While waterfowl hunters adapted to non-lead ammunition, and so will big game hunters. The ammunition is available. Some manufacturers lag behind, but the Barnes Company is out front like Toyota. The rest will catch up. But you as a commission needs to set the standards. Ban lead and the hunters will follow your lead. Our kids will have healthier wildlife populations and game animals that are safe to consume. The facts and the science are positive. Get the lead out of our ammunition. Do the right thing for our state's wildlife. I'd like to take and end this up by saying, as a commission, I would like you to take and do what's right, again, like I say, for the sportsman, for the hunter, as well as for our wildlife and for our kids that are out there, and not to take and listen to the politicians that are telling you how you should be voting out there. We all take and know, even listening this morning, watch out who you kiss, because lipstick's even got lead in it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Coletta. Are you suggesting we're kissing politicians? That thought is repulsive.
Next speaker is Dennis Fox, followed by Virginia Handley, followed by Cindy Margolis.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, members of the commission, I'm Dennis Fox. I'm from Bakersfield, and I used to work for the Forest Service in the Conger Refuge, and I also was president of the Bakersfield Rifle Club. When I worked for the Forest Service, I did some work with the Condors and helped them put the batteries in their little radios and
Mr.
stuff.
Mr. Fox, could you speak into the microphone just a bit more? Thank you, sir.
Okay, how's that?
That's perfect.
There. And what I was mainly going to say is I also found blood in at that time in the Eagles. Both of them are bald, you know, but the Eagles comb their feathers over. But the main thing is two things that I'd like to bring up. I have two concerns. One is that area has muzzleloader hunts. Now, you've lowered the standards for muzzleloaders, which were used to be a primitive weapon, to now they're single shots or just front loading. And what we're looking at there is the twist. One, and also, how do you check a muzzleloader? You know, the wardens would probably have to have bullet pullers, if possible. The rifling twist rate now on these new modern inline rifles, it'd be no problem. However, with the old ones, if you don't have, they're made for balls, lead balls rather than a copper won't work at them. And it probably is going to be a hardship there for both of them. Actually, I would suggest you take a look and see how many it would affect. The twist rate and those lead bullets and lead balls in the old ones do not expand or blow up when they on contact and go in to permeate the tissues. They just flatten out. So I would suggest that maybe a exemption in that instance. Second one, just an exemption for side locks. The next thing would be the fire hazard. If you banned lead, this would be take one comma, two words, another comma. Ban lead cord and steel cord. If you ban the lead cord, you should ban steel cord. Because people go from the lead to the steel, and even ones that have copper. I have it here, and there's a from Serbia. It's imported in Los Angeles, very large company. They sell steel bullets that have copper washes. They sell from Serbia. They have bullets that are steel cord, but with a large copper, and they're getting to be less copper and more steel as the war goes on. And the price goes up. And I think, when it hits a bullet, hits a rock, you have a fire. And that was a concern that I think has been overlooked. Thank you. I'll leave you this.
Thank you, Mr. Fox. Next speaker.
Virginia Handley, followed by Cindy Margolis, followed by Pamela Flick.
Somebody left.
That's part of our AV.
Oh,
you can just
sorry.
Leave it up there. Thank you.
They left the podium, too, Virginia.
I don't know a cell phone when I see one. Virginia Handley, Animal Switchboard. Well, Henry Coletta already stole my lipstick story, as we all heard it on the news this morning. And with the public's concern about lead and the amount of recalls, they are certainly in support of trying to contain this lead. I think if this were ever on the ballot, we would have an educated public already out there. Many good things have already been said in support. I won't go over everything because I don't know everything. But I do think it should cover all the state, or it certainly should be covering the historical range, because the idea is not just to maintain what condor population we have, but we want to see it grow and expand. I also think it should be covering all the guns, and exempting the 22s and, you know, the issue of animals like the ground squirrels that are just killed and just lay out there. That nobody's gathering them up. This gentleman that was here talking about the depredation permits, I think that's very important. And also those that are killing animals, well, and certainly the coyote is the big example, they don't get any depredation permits. So those animals are a real concern that they are out there. The other, the last one, and I've brought this up before, you are required to consider the welfare of individual animals. That is by law. You've taken it out of any in your documents. You used to have a section just on that. And I'm disturbed that it's no longer a specific item that is covered in and of itself, because we really don't have evidence anywhere in writing. I don't even hear discussions that is being taken in concern, not just about a species as a whole, but of the individual animal, too. Thank you.
Thank you, Virginia. Next speaker.
Cindy Margolis, followed by Pamela Flick.
Can you hear me? Okay.
Yes.
I'm a little short for this mic. My name is Cindy Margolis, and today I'm here representing the Oakland Zoo. The Oakland Zoo is an organization which reaches about 600,000 visitors a year and tens of thousands more through our public education and outreach programs. Today, we are adding our voice officially to the call for a ban on toxic bullet hunting within the condor's range and indeed statewide. In our mission at the zoo, it's born in our logo itself, bears the words conservation and education. Those two are intimately entwined. We deal with children. We teach children how to respect wildlife, nature, ecosystems, the environment, and our planet. And we must do the same. We start with conservation by being adequate stewards ourselves of the resources we inherited, and then teaching our children how to be better at it than we were. The California condor is an iconic bird that has been revered by mankind for centuries. Indeed, and unfortunately for the condor was here far before we were, and before we invented bureaucratic means to manage what poisons it. Today, we have a system that breaks down the management of endangered species from the methods that are killing it through this fish and wildlife process. We know that these toxic bullets poison obligate scavengers like condors and 48 other species. We also know that those same toxic elements in those bullets are eaten by hunters' own children when they feed them game animals. It is the right thing for the condor and the right thing for ourselves to save these birds and ourselves by passing a ban on toxic bullets statewide to protect the California condor. I would like to show you a photograph taken just last week, if all the commissioners can probably see it. It is a photograph of Jane Goodall, the most famous wildlife conservationist in the world, addressing a crowd in San Francisco. You'll notice what she's holding is a gigantic feather. It is a feather of a California condor.
She didn't shoot that condor, did she?
She did not.
Oh, thank you.
Needless to say, the condor was molted by a free-flying California condor, and she spoke lovingly and admiringly of the tremendous effort made by the Condor Recovery Program to keep this species from falling over the brink of extinction because of things that man has done. We know, and we are smart enough to do the right thing. Let's do it.
Thank you, Ms. Margolis. Next speaker, please.
Our final speaker on this item today is Pamela Flick.
Welcome back, Pamela.
Final word. Thank you. Good morning, commissioners, commission staff, department staff. Can you hear me? Pamela Flick with Defenders of Wildlife. Thank you for your continued deliberation on this important issue. Defenders urges the commission to adopt alternative 2, which includes the current and historic range, including the Southern Sierra Nevada and deer hunting zones D7, D8, and D9. This area represents the most likely expansion for the condors, and it's also worth noting that condors can fly up to 100 miles a day, making it highly likely that the Southern California population can go into its historic range for foraging trips. The birds need not occupy the territory to forage there. Choosing this alternative would also preclude the commission from having to revisit this issue when condors expand into this area, and they will. It's just a matter of when. We believe that the map could and should be altered to reflect the refinements of A Zone South so that it doesn't include where condors aren't, including the Central Valley, and just have the Southern Sierra added to that. If safe alternatives exist and will be required in current condor country, why not extend such regulations to areas in which the condors feed and most certainly will be moving into in the future? Excuse me. There are two other issues that I'd like to briefly mention, and one of which I brought up in a past meeting, and that is we'd like to see the final decision include assurances that the department will study the appropriateness of extending the non-lead ammunition requirement statewide if the data supports such a decision. And lastly, regarding the exemption of the .22 and smaller caliber projectiles, we'd like to have a statement included that if and when reasonable non-lead alternatives become available, that they're also required in this area. Thank you.
Thank you. Commissioner Sutton?
Pamela, I meant to ask this of Dr. Langham earlier, but we had a couple of presentations yesterday about the reintroduction and re-expansion of the peregrine falcon in California to its historic range. Mm-hmm. It took a number of years and a lot of work on the part of the recovery team to do that. Maybe you can't answer this, but I'm curious how long you think it will take for the condor to reoccupy its historic range. Is there, do you know the rate at which they're being reintroduced in the Southern Sierras? And in other words, is it 2 years or is it 20 years?
I can take a stab at it. The condors are not being reintroduced in the Southern Sierra. They have been moved towards the Bitter Creek Refuge and releasing there. But again, that's within a day's flight from the Southern Sierra. I am not willing to wager a guess as how long it will take, but it's my opinion that eventually the Southern California population will start crossing and migrating and maybe even connect with the Arizona population, which is not, you know, beyond possibilities. So protecting that area right now with this decision, I think, is the most prudent.
Thank you, Ms. Flynn. That concludes our public commentary. John?
One thing I forgot to mention earlier, on the draft environmental document, there actually are a stack of hard copies here today. If anyone is interested in obtaining one, please see Sherry Cole at the table over here. And she can give you one while supplies last. If we run out and you need more, contact the department.
There is a race for the document. Yes, item 23.
Item 23, receipt of public testimony on proposed changes to Section 502, Title 14, related to daily bag limit for canvasback ducks. Please note that the adoption hearing is scheduled for a October 16th teleconference call in Sacramento.
Who's conducting that? Is there any public
There is
speaker?
No DFG presentation
and
on this.
There are no public speakers?
No, there are two public
speakers. There are one public speaker. May we have that, please?
Walt Manzel would like to say a few words about this.
Walter.
Thank you. Walt Manzel, representing California Rifle and Pistol Association. We support the department's efforts in the waterfowl management programs. We recognize the fact that, like many of the marine issues, there are other agencies involved that sometimes have to wave their magic wand before the commission can act, but we are very pleased with the efforts throughout the Pacific Flyway and with the California Fish and Game segment of that program to bring our waterfowl back. Thank you.
Thank you, Walt. 24.
Item 24, receipt of public testimony on proposed changes to Section 630, Title 14, related to ecological reserves. Bill, I see you furrowing.
Bill, did you have a card? Did you have a
if you want to speak, I don't have a card, though.
I had a card. I put one in. I thought I did for the canvas
back. Canvas back. It must have got lost. Go ahead.
Is it on canvas back? Yeah, I can think of you wanting to say something about that issue. Please come forward. Sorry, it was not completely filled out.
There it is.
Please go ahead.
I turned one in.
No, great.
Completely filled out.
No, there's no item.
Oh, I didn't put the item number. I'm sorry. Anyway, President Rogers, members of the commission, department staff, my name is Bill Gaines. I am president of the California Outdoor Heritage Alliance, and it's a pleasure to be in front of you here today. We strongly support the department's efforts to move forward with the revised CEQA documentation to support a change to two canvasback in California. As I mentioned during testimony during the first August hearing, canvasback are at an all-time high this year, and certainly, you know, an increase in the limit from one to two in the daily bag is warranted, and we appreciate the department's willingness to go through that process and the commission's willingness to consider such a change. We strongly support it. Thank you very much, Bill.
Item 24.
Item 24, receipt of public testimony on proposed changes to Section 630, Title 14, related to ecological reserves. Please note the adoption hearing is scheduled for November 2nd in Sacramento. There is no DFG testimony on this issue today, and at this point we have no speaker cards for this issue.
Any comments or questions from the commission? Commissioner Kellogg?
No.
Okay.
I'd like to bring it to the attention of the commission that we've had three members of the public ask to speak on an item from the consent calendar, item 26.
So we'll take that now.
Okay.
Instead of, or do you want to do the consent calendar first?
And no, let's take that.
Let's take 26 first, yep. And then go to 26. Then the others. Rather.
So item 26 is request to publish notice of commission intent to amend Section 671, Title 14, related to importation, transportation, and possession of live restricted animals. Please note that the discussion hearing is scheduled for November 2nd in Sacramento. We have three speaker cards on this issue. There is no department presentation.
Okay, let's take our public comments.
Eric Mills, followed by Mark Arrington, followed by Virginia Handley.
Good morning again, commissioners. Eric Mills, Coordinator of Action for Animals in Oakland. First of all, Mr. Rogers, watch your back. I'm going to tell Jane Goodall what you said about that condor. You're going to be in big trouble. Secondly, a kind word for Texas, in spite of some of the derogatory remarks, which I made a few myself. Just this month, I believe, they have instituted a new policy in Texas, the Fish and Game, I guess it's the commission there, a ban on the commercial take of many species of turtles, which are ending up in the Chinese markets. And I wonder how many of those same turtles have been coming to California. Lots, I would assume. Again, I had high hopes this year that the proposed ban on frog and turtle importation and sale for the live animal markets would be on this agenda item. Apparently that is not to be. I would like to remind the commission that we've done, I think, 19 necropsies on the frogs and turtles in the markets without exception. They were diseased and parasitized, everything from Salmonella, E. coli, Pastorella, all three of which can kill you, plus blood parasites, Giardia, one case of malaria. It is illegal under the Fish and Game Code and the state health laws to sell diseased and parasitized animals for human consumption, yet it goes on unabated. 2 years ago in the markets, I was seeing Chinese soft-shell turtles carrying God knows what from another continent being dumped. Religious groups continue to dump these animals into the wild. I have a photograph of an American bullfrog eating a baby Western pond turtle, a protected species, which we're about to lose. It seems like a common sense thing to me, just like protecting the creek fish in Oakland and the condor. It's just as important and overriding. What I find amusing, if it weren't so, whatever it is, in this report that the commission has out on the consent calendar, the Kochi frog is listed. I've heard of Kochi frogs. They're not a threat to the environment. They're tiny little critters. All they do is make a lot of racket, which is basically what I do but nobody pays much attention. But the frogs are being put on the consent calendar for a ban as a, what do they say here? If established in California, they may compete with small native predators such as birds, reptiles, and amphibians for insect prey, eating mosquitoes, I presume. Well, how serious is that in comparison to protection for these turtles and frogs? All of the turtles are taken from the wild in other states. They're allowed in this state only because old Steve Taylor, wherever he is, okayed it himself. He was the one who put these three species of animals on the list. Softshell turtles, red-eared sliders, and American bullfrogs. They're already here, so it's not a problem. And Saki Maestrop keeps stressing that we keep talking about the humane issues, which are considerable. But we're here for environmental protection, because these animals displace the natives, they eat the natives, they eat the game fish that a lot of the fishermen have been here this week are trying to fish for. It's a major deal. Cookie frog, it's a joke, comparatively. And I'm hoping for better for this commission before I die. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Rick. Next speaker.
Mark Arrington, followed by Virginia Handley.
President Rogers and members of the Commission, my name is Mark Eglinton. I'm the owner of Blue Beyond Fisheries. We produce tilapia in a closed recirculation system in Southern California. I'm here to state why barramundi should not be included in the restricted species list. The main premise that Fish and Game has used is that animals listed below are non-native invasive species. That's correct, they're non-native, but they are not invasive anywhere in the world, and this is documented extensively that they are non-invasive. Secondly, we're dealing with a problem that we have a report that has been put out by Seafood Watch that you have in front of you. It's an extremely extensive, well-researched scientific report on barramundi, stating that farm-grown U.S. barramundi is a best choice and very, very environmentally friendly and safe. Unfortunately, when I first came before the commission on February 1st, this information I wasn't able to have because I didn't know about it, and certainly the commission didn't either. But barramundi only exist on native in northern Australia, Southeast Asia, and southern China. They cannot establish in North America, and in fact cannot even establish in the wild in southern Australia, and only grown in closed recirculation systems. If you look outside today, this is not a tropical climate at all. We got 51 degrees, there's cold water everywhere. These fish cannot survive and establish. The optimum water temperature for spawning is about 82 degrees, and it's a very, very close, narrow temperature boundary. They have been found at 16 degrees very, very, very temporarily, which is about 60 Fahrenheit, but they do not feed, and at that point they die. They stop feeding at 20 degrees centigrade, which is about 70 degrees Fahrenheit. They are hermaphrodites. They're born as males. They mature at 3 to 5 years. They're hermaphrodites. Some will change to female at about 5 to 8 years old. It's based on suitability of climate. You're talking 8 years for a fish, or 5 to 8 years for a fish to be able to start to spawn. Spawning occurs after monsoons. Fish are eurihalines. The males migrate from fresh rivers down to saline mangrove estuaries where the females live. As stated in the report, these conditions do not exist in North America, let alone California. On the 3rd of November, I sent a letter to Fish and Game asking for a barramundi permit. There was no response, no questions or comments. In late January, I was notified that I could present on February 1st. At the commission meeting, which I did. At that time, I had no idea that the Fish and Game had any problems because there was no communication whatsoever. I couldn't prepare for the few issues that they had nailed me on, which basically caused commission to decline my application.
Please go ahead.
My application. Firstly, what has been put in here is escape. Okay. Well, escape is useless because they cannot exist in California. They cannot establish and grow to the extent of being able to be a viable population. Secondly, and more importantly, is the disease aspect that was touted as just being discovered. Well, nodovirus, which is used in the paperwork that Fish and Game put out for this thing, nodovirus exists in California as well. It's actually been very well documented. There was a research paper funded by California Fish and Game in part. It's been in existence in California, noted, since 1992. The extensive research is done by Hubs, SeaWorld, and San Diego, amongst other worldwide research bases. And there's successful, treatment protocols that have been instituted, namely and primarily is ozone, using ozone to clean the water, which is something that we use just for tilapia, let alone for anything more valuable like barramundi or higher species. My application was denied on additional issues as well, all of which I countered at the August restricted species meeting where this proposal was being promulgated. I presented a significant amount of information, including that report, at which point I was told that basically, if it's not native to California, we don't want it. That's what we were told by Fish and Game. And the other comment that was, if it is here, it will escape. These are not scientific bases for being able to control an industry, and especially an emerging and very important industry. Fish and Game used the Seafood Watch report on salmon to stop salmon fishing in California. And basically, it's disingenuous to now say that the report does not have enough merit to mitigate concerns about barramundi.
You do need to summarize at this point.
Okay. So basically, at this point, we do not believe that it is right that barramundi is included in this particular situation.
Thank you, Mr. Eglinton. Commissioner Sutton?
Thanks for your testimony, for bringing this to our attention, and for distributing the very fine work of my staff at the aquarium on this issue. Just wanted to point out a couple of things. First of all, the analysis that we conduct to underpin the Seafood Watch recommendations at the aquarium have mainly to do with the sustainability of fish farming and fisheries. Mm-hmm. The analysis the department does to decide whether or not to permit aquaculture for a certain species in California is different. Yeah, obviously, there are different considerations. The Seafood Watch report is good food for thought for the state, but it's not that it doesn't. Their inquiry doesn't end there, mm-hmm. for obvious reasons. We have lots of history around the world that suggests prima facie evidence that farming of non-native species can be dangerous to the environment. Not necessarily in this case, but in many other cases, there have been lots of unintended consequences of farming of non-indigenous species. So, as a precautionary measure, the state, I think, has been cautious here. Now, they may have been overcautious, which I think is your point. And I'd like to see the department go back and revisit this for a variety of reasons. But the department, and I'll read from their draft here, suggests that, quote, barramundi pose a threat to California's native fisheries through predation, competition for food, and transmission of diseases and parasites, unquote. You've suggested that that's an erroneous finding, that we need to revisit that, and I tend to agree with that. But I just wanted to point out the difference between what you presented here in terms of the Seafood Watch report and the analysis the state is required to do on their own.
Thank you, Commissioner Sutton. Any further questions from the... I would request, John, that by our next meeting, if it would be at all possible, I agree with Commissioner Sutton's commentary. I also believe, as Mr. Eglinton has suggested, that seafood farming is a very important thing for us to be doing and promoting in the state of California. In order for me to vote against Barramundi, I need to know much finer information as to specifically why, because right now I'm really not convinced that that is true. So I'm sympathetic with your point of view, and I want to be very, very certain that we don't just categorize Barramundi simply because it's a non-native fish as having all of the attributes of some of the really negative ones that we do know about. So if we can come to the conclusion that Barramundi does not pose a significant threat to the environment, then the overwhelming benefits of having a sustainable fishery in aquaculture in California, which would offset the need for predation of a whole bunch of other fish that we already know are endangered in the state of California, seems to me as a darn fine idea. So we just need more information, John, if that would be possible.
May I make one comment?
If the director could...
And I certainly will have that information developed for you. For your information, we do have a very active and aggressive aquaculture program in the state, and we have been very reluctant to introduce new species, I think, since 1997.
And I think rightly so, John. Don't take me wrong there.
Okay.
I agree.
So that history is there for the department.
I understand. Please.
Unfortunately, by virtue of this aggressive anti-aquaculture expansion idea from Fish and Game, we're coming up to a point where we're effectively mandating exporting the misuse, for instance, of environments in other parts of the world, number one, because not everybody has the controls, not every country has the controls that we have here. EPA, FDA, all of the various entities that control what we do. And, there's cage farming that you will see of Barramundi that happens in Vietnam, very anti-environmental as far as that goes. And, we have a serious deficit here. And Fish and Game mentioned when I did present that if they had their time over again, they wouldn't even allow us to grow tilapia here or catfish. Well, there's only 5 food species that are produced in California, and there's only one that's native, and that's sturgeon. Everything else has been brought into this country. And Fish and Game, with the Coachella Valley Water District, were the ones that brought tilapia into the state. They do not. There's a limit for where tilapia can be grown other than by special permit, which is the Tehachapi Mountains, north of the Tehachapi Mountains. Tilapia does not exist in the wild north of the mountains. And the reason why is not because of the law that was promulgated, but because they cannot exist there. It's too cold. They cannot reproduce and they cannot live. So it's restricted by environment, which
Thank
is
you.
The same with this.
Thank you for your presentation.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. President, just a
Commissioner Sutton.
Quick suggestion. From a technical perspective, this is the notice hearing. So I don't have any problem with going to notice based on this document with the exceptions and comments that we've made noted.
Good point.
That was the same comment I was going to make. So with that being said...
One more public speaker. I'm sorry.
Oh, we do?
Yes, we do. We have
Virginia Handley, last public speaker on this issue.
Guess what? Virginia Handley, Animal Switchboard, and I won't go over again with everything that that Eric said, and I think he said it very well. I wish that we would have had the sliders and the frogs, that the commission would have done this 20 years ago. So I noticed on the water snake where that animal's being added, they think that they were thought to have started from pets that were released, same place that I think we started with the first releases. Now it's not just the pet trade, it's the live animal market trade. That's where these animals are coming from, and that could so easily be stopped. And for the snake, the potential for the impacts of the giant garter snake. There has been no lack of environmental information given to this commission, and to somehow intimate that there is no environmental impact or that somehow that is lacking is insulting to to everybody's intelligence. We can turn around and give you back your own material of the evidence of the impacts of these animals on the environment. Now, I can understand you don't want to give out pet permits. I understand the logistical problems that that you might have to face. That's why I would just limit it the importation of the ones coming into the markets. My fear is not just maybe it's a little bit of logistics that you don't like. I also think it's politics, and I think it's political cowardice not to face this issue because you don't want to take on the opposition to it. That is insulting to all of us.
Thank you, Virginia. No further commentary. Go back to the consent calendar.
Oh, I'm sorry, we do need a motion and a vote to move this along.
Ah, true enough.
Item 26 as a request to publish notice.
Do I hear that motion?
Move the consent calendar.
No, actually, item 26.
Since
first.
Item 26 was
pulled out.
We're going to pull it out?
You know, it we was did. Pulled out. We just we discussed it. So, we can actually, you know, you're quite right. You're quite right. I'm sorry, Jim. You were quite right.
I'm sorry, Jim.
I don't remember being wrong, Richard.
Because that would include item 26.
Items 25 through 30 on the consent calendar. Suggested motion is to approve the consent calendar as item 25 through 30.
Do I hear a second?
Second.
Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
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 Unanimous. Thank you.
And that leaves us to announcement of future meetings. Our November meeting is in Sacramento. October 16th, we're doing a teleconference call on the canvas-backed duck issue. Then November 1st, 2nd, we're in Sacramento. December 6th and 7th, we're in Sacramento.
Are there any business any of the commissioners wish to raise? Any commentary? Do I have a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Seconded? All those in favor say aye. Aye. Thank you, everyone, for attending. We stand adjourned.